This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Tom Hanks hasn't had one remarkable, universally familiar movie role. He's had a dozen.
May I ask who you are?
My name's Forrest. Forrest Gump.
I have a case. If you don't want it for personal reasons.
Thank you. That's correct. I don't.
There's no crying in baseball!
Houston, we have a problem.
I'll see you on the beach.
He's also been a movie director and a TV producer. One thing he doesn't have much experience at is live theater. He hasn't acted in a play since the early 1980s. But Tom Hanks is on Broadway right now, starring in the last work by Nora Ephron. It's called Lucky Guy, and it's about a New York tabloid journalist named Mike McAlary.
I am a newspaper reporter, and I love my job. And I'm doing God's work. I'm serving the public. I'm telling people what happened yesterday. I'm telling them the facts.
Unlike a lot of the characters Tom Hanks has played, McAlary doesn't have an obvious heart of gold. When he first read the script, Hanks thought McAlary seemed like a jerk.
Well, he was. He was just kind of a jerk. Can you say a**hole on public radio?
I think you can say
a**hole. Oh, there you go. I love this. I love this. There's perks and burdens, and that's one of the perks, I guess. And I did not know him. I had not read him. But years later, la la la, da da da. Let's throw the calendar pages, the front.
Cue that music too.
The time passing montage music. And a couple of years ago, I saw Nora all the time, and we talked always about what we were up to. And she said, "Well, I did another version of that play. I've been working on that play about that guy you said was an a**hole." I said, "Oh, well, let me read it again." And from that came our production at the Broadhurst.
So when was that? When did you commit to this?
I committed to it after we had what is known as a 29-hour workshop production, I'm going to say a year ago last January.
Huh. And a year ago last January, you had, like most of her friends, had no idea she was sick?
I had no idea that she was ill.
Would you have done it if this particular play, if your friend and multiple collaborator Nora Ephron hadn't written it?
Well, she was definitely a great attraction because Nora was a good hang. She was a fun person to spend as much time with as possible. You always ate well. You always laughed. You were always constantly talking about the pulse of the nation and the world at the time.
And the seriousness gossip sandwich was kind of perfect balance.
Oh God, yeah. And I thought, I love a good juicy, bone to chew every now and again, and Nora would just clear the plate as far as what was really going on gossip-wise all around the world. She was fun. I don't know. Yes, I think the play was fascinating enough. Wanting to come and do a Broadway show is, I think, in the DNA of every actor that's out there, particularly one that used to live on 45th Street right around the corner from where the theater is. So, and not knowing the story of Mike McAlary, this was brand new turf for me.
And this is the first play you've done in 30 plus?
Bona fide play, yes. I put together performances for the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival as benefits and whatnot over
which
the
is year. Where you started.
It was in Cleveland, yeah. Actually, now the Great Lakes Theater Festival, for those that are listening in public radio and in Cleveland, thank you very much.
WCPN.
Oh, heck, okay, you beat me to it. But no, I have not done a professional play since 1981.
So how well did you and how did you adapt to all of it? The memorizing the lines, the tightrope every night, all that stuff.
That's nothing, really. What? That's just the process.
Sounds like a scary part of the process.
Well, when you start working on it, I began meeting with Maura Tierney, who plays Alice McAlary, and George Wolfe, who was our director, on the 7th of January. And if you can't figure out, the words between now and then. I'm trying to figure – because everybody asks that question, how do you remember all those lines?
And I hope that's the stupid way in which I
No. You actually put in a very challenging form. This is what it's like. It's like listening to your favorite album over and over again. And I would guess I could probably recite to you every word of Bruce Springsteen's Darkness on the Edge of Town. And that's what it's like. It's like you learn the record and you know what's coming up next. You know how long the pauses are. You know when the trumpets blare. You know where.
But
where
so what about all the rest? The different muscles that stage acting.
Well, that's a bitch. Yeah. That is a fascinating physiological process to go through. At the age of 56, it's amazing how long a bruise on your hip can last just from our roly-poly fight scene that we have. But that is it. It ends up being the tactile aspect of doing the play is that there is a physiology to it that requires rest and requires moving around. And somewhere between 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock in the evening, when we're getting ready for the performances, whether I like it or not, the body is sort of transformed. And you're geared up and ready to go.
And your mental state the rest of the time is no different than the rest of your life?
I find I keep the play in a box in my head, and I don't let anything else in there until I have to open it and then begin. We are still in rehearsal, so I have this kind of like delicious excuse for hiding from everything that goes on in the world. I can't balance my checkbook now. I'm in rehearsals. I can't figure out this email about the kid's school meeting with the parent teacher. I have rehearsals.
So you really get to be an artiste?
I do. Yeah. Oh, it's all fake, but yeah, I actually do get to have it. I have a beret and everything.
And you're in New York. Do you hang in the Village with a cigarette on your fingers?
A herbal cigarette.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I walk around. I used to try to walk around like James Dean, you know, that great iconographic photograph of him with the Times Square with an overcoat and the cigarette. No. And now I try to walk around like Mike McElary with my tie undone and a cigarette in my mouth.
Doing this show and doing, you know, this stage performance in front of 1,000 people every night, are the highs higher than in film acting, or is it just an apple to an orange?
It's an apple to an orange. The I think doing Lucky Guy is like playing an NBA basketball game every night. It's rock'em sock'em. It's very fast. You're up and down the court. And sometimes you sink it and sometimes you don't, but you get to play. You get to do it again tomorrow night, which is great. Motion pictures are kind of like war games, you know. There's a lot of the logistics of it all, and sometimes the hours are totally, totally inhuman. But you have to, again, you have to keep the movie and the role inside this box in your head, because for perhaps 45 minutes, four times a day, you are going to be recording something that is going to last forever. And if you're not truly behaving there at that time, you have failed to do your job.
That seems to me like a more bizarre, unhuman thing, movie acting.
Totally.
Than this.
It is.
You're 2 hours, you pretend to be somebody else, it's over.
It is. Everybody knows they're in the theater.
Yeah.
You know, everybody knows that you're going off stage and changing costumes. The things that happen in motion pictures are the sun is coming up because it's a night shot. You have to cry and have a very emotional scene with somebody else with you. And you literally have today to get it, because tomorrow the company is leaving Normandy and they cannot bring everybody back. And you're going to be back in Culver City on Monday morning. It's merciless. It is merciless. And it is a very odd thing. And that's why so many actors start craving nuts after a while. The pressure breaks them.
You started off doing theater in Cleveland. When you got cast in this TV series at 24, did you think, I'll do that for a few years?
Are you insane? I thought this is the greatest thing that's ever.
I'm on my way to Hollywood.
No, it's like, you know what I'm saying? I'm going to get paid. No, I growing up in Los Angeles, I grew up in Northern California, and I knew a lot of people that went down to L.A., and I said, I'm not going there until they invite me, if that happens. Which was a relatively smart thing to do, because I went in with a job, and the job was a blast, and I met Peter Scolari, who was in Lucky Guy, so we're kind of like...
He's everywhere. He's in Girls. He's in Lucky Guy.
Yeah, how about that guy? How about that? Look, I always thought, what's the next... I've reached some brand of horizon here. If I can get a job outside of Cleveland, I'll be ahead of the game, and then getting the TV show. If I can get a job outside of half-hour videotaped sitcom, I'll be ahead of the game. That's all I was trying to do.
And so your commitment to the theater was not, as many young actors are, is, I'm going to keep doing theater.
Look, I find it the opportunity comes along and you have to be flexible enough to do it. I will tell you with no lie, absolutely no lie. When I went to college in Sacramento, I saw actors that are as good as any I've ever worked with or have been able to watch. And the difference was that I had the opportunity to go away, so I went. I find that to be the great advantage of having somebody call you up and say, I'm doing this thing, would you like to come out and do it? Actors say yes, unless, you know, literally physically or personal responsibilities keep them from doing so.
As an actor in the movies, you have a really high batting average of commercially and creatively successful movies. I mean, I was amazed during the 90s you had like a dozen straight like BAFFO things. I mean, really straight. It was incredible.
B-O-F-F-O. That's the
exactly.
way to spell it.
No, I want to speak more like Variety.
Okay. All right. Well,
how much of the credit for those choices would you allocate to luck, your agents, you?
Look, I will have to say luck plays an awful big part of it because somebody has to initiate the phone call to you. At the end of the day, I don't get to make any of these decisions except yes or no. And it is very, very easy to say yes to whatever opportunity comes across the pike. I felt as though at that time in the 90s where things were clicking along pretty well is that that's when I learned to say no to the other things that would have taken me out of the marketplace. There was a time, for example, I sat down with my crack staff of representatives and I said, look, can I say on the air? Okay. I said, I'm not going to play. And I mean that in the term of like
wusses is the
wusses. Okay. I'm not going to play wusses anymore. I don't want to play a guy who can't figure out his life and does it because that's the type of role I had played from the age of 27 to about 35. And I said, look, I've explored that as much as I want to. I want to play a man who experiences bitter compromise in his life because that's what I've experienced thus far in my life. And that's about the only thing I think you can do. You can't set yourself out to say, I'm only going to do this brand of work because if nobody asks you to do this brand of work, you'll never have that opportunity. I think you have to surf, if you will, the big waves of chance that come your way because other people were involved. If Ron Howard hadn't cast me in the jobs that he did, if Bob Zemeckis hadn't seen something in Forrest Gump, if Jonathan Demme hadn't cold called me out of nowhere
to do
Philadelphia, then I would never have been able to manufacture those opportunities by myself.
And then when you make the very rare mistake, or what people regard as a mistake, like Bonfire of the Vanities, is that traumatizing?
Well, you are going back to the 90s, aren't you?
Is that traumatizing? Or do you say, okay, how do I avoid making that mistake? Or is it just, you make mistakes sometimes?
There's no such thing as Michael Jordan, you know, he only won so many, champion rings. He played basketball where, they were eliminated in the playoffs in the first or second round. That is just part of the batting average. The thing is, the economic industry that goes along, the people that report on how things work, and the great sweepstakes of motion pictures, there's winners and losers every single week. In America, really, they only ask you about the hits. They will go back to the ones that made money, the Forrest Gumps and whatnot. And they only talk about the stuff that was really in the national consciousness so much that they remembered it. In Europe, they always ask you about the last movie they saw.
Tell me about Joe and the Volcano.
Yeah, they want to say, no, then Larry Crown. I must say, Mr. Hanks, the Larry Crown. And if I mention Larry Crown in the United States, even on Studio 360, it's a punchline. And then, Kurt, along comes Larry Crown. Ba-dum-cha. So it's like that. But look, I there's only one yardstick for success, and that is longevity. And the more bombs, that means I've had some BAFFO ones as well. So just put them up there on the shelf, and that means I'm doing okay.
Speaking of Larry Crown, not as a punchline at all.
Oh, I love this.
And that thing you do. So you've directed two feature films.
Yes,
you've directed
yes.
episodes of your wonderful HBO series as well. What have you learned about directing and how it does or doesn't jibe with your skills, the requirements of it versus what you can do?
I think every director should have to act in a movie to see how hard that is to do at 3 o'clock in the morning. I think they should because then they will become human beings, those that aren't. By and large, I've had great relationship with directors. I think all actors should try to direct something, and they will find out how important it is to have actors show up on time, to know what they are going to do in the scene, and to have ideas beyond those that you have communicated to them. When I have directed, movies are a different kind of beast because you're at the mercy of a much longer schedule. Television, what we've done for this miniseries for HBOs, those are tight, wonderful, kind of like six-week experiences that are very frenetic, but you really only have to figure out about 55 minutes of a three-act structure, and that stuff is golden because you're under pressure and you have to make make it short, and you have to make it quick, and you have to make it to the point. Movies can, you can shoot and 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 then figure it out later on. But what I have gotten from all of that stuff, I'm a better collaborator now with writers and directors than I was prior to that, because I just know the constraints that they're under. I know how bad it can be when a guy or somebody in the cast shows up and says, "What are we doing today?" I said, "Buddy, if you don't know what we're doing today, I'm so screwed, because I really need you as an ally here in order to move this thing beyond where I think it should be." So I'm really, I have less ego now, if I can be so bold, humbly.
Yes. Let me tell you how little ego I have.
Let me tell you how humble I am. Let me tell you how little ego I have. I love it when a director comes up to me and says, "Don't do that." Then it's gone. I don't even think about it anymore. And I love it when a director comes out and says, "What was that about?" I said, "I was just giving it a shot." "We'll explore that a little bit more." Well, that's golden, man. Then I feel like I won the sweepstakes.
Speaking of being an actor, when I was thinking about movie clips that we might play during this conversation, I realized that many of your greatest moments in movies are visual, without dialogue, like the dancing in Big and the run in Forrest Gump. I mean, you're kind of a silent movie star in a certain way. And I wonder if that physicality that you bring to particular roles is something you kind of figure out very carefully.
Well, they come out very organically in the course of doing it. And you cannot sit in your hotel room at night and say, "I'm going to walk this way." You have to wait till you're there in the real space and you have the real costume on, and you get a sense of how big you are or how large you are in the frame that is communicated to you by the director. But listen, I would love to do a movie that is completely silent. I try to take out as many lines as possible. In fact, storytelling-wise, when Bob Zemeckis and I made Castaway, and we were on the island in Fiji for 6 weeks at a time, we had a script that was written by Bill Broyles and us that was loaded with all this verbiage. "Well, what am I going to do now? Well, shoot, that looks like it is an island. Dang, I gotta figure out a way to get some fire here." Literally, he was saying stuff like that, and Bob and I said, "There's no reason for him to be talking like this. The only reason to talk is if he thinks somebody is there." So prior to the birth of Wilson the volleyball, who gave me somebody to talk about, the only thing I said, "Who's there?" thinking someone was out there. Or "Help," thinking there was a ship out at sea. And all the other lines, it became a silent movie, and it just became about behavior and procedure, which since doing that movie is the thing that I try to I think that's a strength that I have, is looking at, well, what is the behavior of a guy here and what is the procedure that he has to go through in order to work the beat in the scene.
In the last decade or so, most of the projects you've worked on as a producer, maybe all of them, have been explorations of American history of one kind or another. John Adams, Band of Brothers, Pacific, Game Change, this wonderful documentary series, From the Earth to the Moon. Has that always been your sweet spot?
Yes, it has, because I've been reading nonfiction since I was in high school. I discovered In Cold Blood when I was about 15.
Nice.
I remember that famous Dick Cavett-Truman Capote argument on air of if it's possible to write was a nonfiction novel or something like that. Knowing that that had actually happened and wasn't just the creepy imaginings of a writer really affected me quite deeply. And then I went off and read other versions of the same thing, like Leon Uris's books, Mila 18 and Trinity and Armageddon, Exodus, things like that. And that just always drove me towards being much more fascinated by things that really happened as opposed to novels that have been made up. And I still only read. I drive my wife nuts because there I am reading, you know, another Vincent Bugliosi book or Don Miller's Masters of the Air or something like that in bed, because "Are you ever going to read just a novel?" And I said, "I don't think so, babe, because it just doesn't have the same juju as knowing that this stuff really happened."
And as an American history specialist, as a
layman, yes,
producer, lay specialist. Do you have a sense of when America's golden age was? You're not running for office.
No. So I don't have to say that. It actually is always. I think it's always around the corner. It truly is. Something will come down the pike that will not be recognized for another 20 years. I think, for example, now, I think we're looking back at, we have been looking at the 60s for quite a while. And here are the 10th anniversary. We're just recording this the day after the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq War. It takes a while for all of this stuff to ferment or to cook in the crock pot. And we could be writing about and doing miniseries in the future about the year 2014, 2015, but we won't get around to it until 2040. I think that you could go back to an era where I was alive from 50. I was born in 56. So for about 15 years, I was told over and over again that we live in amazing times. This is astounding what we are achieving right now. And there was no internet. You know, you made long-distance phone calls over copper wire.
Rarely.
You had to wait for those. If you wrote a letter, you had to put a 6-cent stamp on it, and it took 4 days to get across the country sometime. And yet, we were living in amazing times. The generation right before us had experienced this horrible thing called the Depression, which meant that if you got an abscess tooth, you could die from the poison that was in your head. And the generation right before mine woke up one day and had to go down and sign a piece of paper and fly in airplanes and go across the country and fight with monsters. I'm sorry. That's what it was. And then in the 50s, there was this gurgling kind of like a whiff and poof psalm that was right underneath Roy Cohn and Joe McCarthy at the same time. And then when I was...
Nicely put.
When I was actually coming of age... and started doing things like understanding there were newspapers and whatnot and paying more attention to all of history that went on. Some guy decided to climb into a bookstore in Dealey Plaza and take out the most charming human being that had ever graced the political stage. All of that stuff was going on at the same exact time people were telling us, and we live in an amazing, amazing time. Vietnam was going on, and none of it made sense. And that was, I think, the beginning of the turning of just about everything. But I think if you're looking at a golden age of American history, there's a magnificent book that Nora Ephron gave me called The Age of Aspirin. Very good writers went back and examined the most amazing stories almost a decade previously. Some of the stories were about the Dion quintuplets. And actually, the true story of the Dion quintuplets is pretty fascinating because those babies all should have died, you know. But also, there's a long story on Amy Simple McPherson. Who was probably the most powerful. She was the Oprah of her day, and she was equally as powerful. So reading that kind of really great journalism of true history means, like, look, it's just the same story over and over again. The technology is different. The personalities are different. And I must say, in 1966, nobody my age was going to fill rock concerts to hear music that was recorded 30 years previously. 1966, no one was going to hear people sing songs from 1936. But here we are.
I think about that all the time. And I'm not sure it's entirely a good thing either.
Well, I was in London, and I happened to we were working, and I happened to get tickets to the Cream reunion concert. So that's Ginger Baker,
Clapton,
Eric Clapton, and Jack Bruce. And this was like the thing that was happening, that the town was coming to a standstill. You're going to go see Cream at the Royal Albert Hall. And we were in the back of the hall, and down before us was nothing but a sea of bald spots. Every man there had a bald spot in the back of his head. And I thought, this is amazing. This would be like my dad saying, hey, Rudy Valli is doing a concert at the Royal Albert Hall. Let's go. I don't know what the point of that is, other than it seems that now more everything lasts forever, everything is accessible. And so in the great sweep of the altruistic meter, it may not seem things are at the high point at any given day to day. But look, the greatest opportunities for us as a nation are always around the corner.
And it's always the best of times and the worst of times.
Yeah, it's always the tale of the two cities.
You've got this mustache because the guy you're playing in this play wore a mustache. But you started the mustache, I guess, because you played Walt Disney in a movie
that's
about to come out called Saving Mr. Banks, which I never thought of this before, but I read – Walt Disney has never been played on screen before until this. In order to play him, did you read a lot? How did you get into that head?
This is a very goofy story, but when I was in New York City as an unemployed actor, I had a library card from the public library on 42nd Street. And I actually had read a biography of Walt Disney then that stuck with me because he was always nearly penniless. And he always got screwed by businessmen. He just wanted to make funny cartoons. And luck and pluck and talent and wherewithal stuck to it. And out it came. So but the Disney that I knew was that guy on Sunday nights who said, "And tonight we'll take a walk through Disneyland by night."
Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color.
And it was always I never cared for the Greta the Lonesome Greyhound episodes of the Walt Disney Show, but when he was going to talk about the new audio animatronic technology that was going to be in the Enchanted Tiki Room, well, that was like dropping acid or something like that. It was the greatest way you could spend a Sunday night. So playing him, the first thing I sort of wanted to do was get down his vocal Midwest cadence. And I went up. His daughter, Diane, has set up through the family's fabulous museum in San Francisco that is so chock-a-block with interactive video and I listened. I went up there on a day that it was closed, and they turned everything on for me. And I looked at and listened to every piece of footage and recorded tape that they had to come back with a kind of, oh, he has a, let me tell you a story about a young man from Kansas City, who had a dream about mouse. I wanted to call him Mortimer, but Mrs. Disney felt that Mortimer was too long, people wouldn't get it, so she said, we'll name him Mickey.
Tom Hanks, it has been a pleasure, as I knew it would be, talking to you today. Thank you.
Delightful. Thank you. Big time fan, first time caller.
Well, they're still racing down at the trestle. But that blood had never burned in her veins. Now I hear she's got a house up in Fairview, in a style she's driving.